You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connect Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this fine Thursday in Lent. And we are, today is being Thursday, we will shortly have my Thursday co-host, Reverend Mr. or Deacon, Stephen Gardonis will be on the show today. We'll be talking about life at the movies. Excuse me. So we had Rod Bennett on the show yesterday, and we spent a little time talking about the issue of the death penalty and of our attitude toward human life in general. And I wanted to follow up on that a little bit because there is, you know, Rod was making the point that people seem to have the idea that the purpose of just war theory the goal is to sort of jump through some hoops that God has set up so that if you're able to navigate all those hoops, then you get to start killing people. That your reward is that you are handed a 007 by the church, and the suspension. There's a suspension of the normal rule against killing people, and now you get to kill. And it's a very strange approach, but a lot of people seem to have this idea that under certain circumstances, the church somehow is allowed by God to give you a 007 to commit mortal sin, and it won't be mortal sin. In fact, it'll be good, and you'll get brownie points, and you'll be a hero for it under these certain conditions. And none of that is true, but people have this crazy idea that that's what's going on with the church's teaching. And so I thought it might be useful just to kind of look over what's going on with the church's just war doctrine, because that seems to be the problem. Is people don't seem to understand it. Hang on just one second. We're trying to get a hold of Stephen Gardonis. Danny, he's on Skype, so give him a try. Anyway, so when we're talking about just war doctrine, there are basically four criteria that the church has for just war doctrine. The first criteria is that the damage, the first thing you need is you need to have an aggressor who poses a lasting, grave, and certain threat. That means that you can never have preemptive war. And this is a shock to a lot of people. This is a whole appeal that was made at the beginning of the Iraq War. Several Catholic theologians, including Michael Novak, went to Rome and made this pitch for a preemptive war against Saddam Hussein. And the response of then Cardinal Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, was short and sweet. The concept of preventive war is not in the catechism. In other words, no, you haven't even met the first criteria for just war. So this war is not a just war. was the response of Ratzinger. It was also the response of Pope John Paul II and all the bishops of the world. And yet, incredibly, people who argued for the war actually tried to say, ah, preventive war is not in the catechism. That means the catechism doesn't address it, and that means it's okay. Which is an amazingly perverse reading. I think we got Steve Gradonis on the line now. Oh, we don't. Okay. Ah, all right. Well, then we will just continue this discussion. And, oh, looks like you've maybe got him. Oh, do we have me now?
Hello.
Hello there. All right, we do. We've got Stephen Gradonis on the line. Hi. How you
Hi.
Doing?
Are we on the air?
We are. We are on the air.
Is this live radio?
This is live radio, and I am your host, Mark Shea.
Always an adventure.
Yes, it is. It's just, this is how live radio works. So I was just doing, I'm sort of finishing up a discussion we had yesterday with Rod Bennett, talking about you.
Is Rod Bennett on the phone?
No, he is not.
Oh.
I was just finishing up a discussion. We had a discussion yesterday. We wound up talking about just war doctrine.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so I thought it might be good to review, since a lot of people are apparently unfamiliar with just war doctrine, what the criteria of a just war is. So I just mentioned the first criteria, which is the damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations has to be lasting, grave, and certain. Well, that means there's no such thing, as Cardinal Ratzinger said, as preventive war. You can't say, you know, I'm pretty sure that maybe 10 years down the line, that guy over there is going to do something bad, so I'm going to just kill him now.
Right.
There's a word for that. If you extend that thinking back just a few years earlier, it's called abortion. And you will get, in fact, arguments from people like Steven Pinker and the authors of Freakonomics that's why abortion is good, because if you kill them now, then they're not going to, they will lower crime later. And you'll get arguments like that. But it's the same idea. No, you don't go to war on the fear that something might happen. That's the first thing. The next thing is all other means of putting an end to the danger have to have been shown to be impractical or ineffective.
Yes.
You don't just rush in and start killing people. And the question then becomes, why not? And the answer of the church is because they're people. You don't kill people if you don't have to kill them. Because they're made in the image and likeness of God, you know,
this is an extension or a particular application of the principle of double effect.
Right.
But in fact, just war theory as a whole is it really a specification of the principle of double effect. And one of the things that the principle of double effect states is that you can't. Sometimes it's permissible to do things that are illicit if there is a good enough reason, even though there's going to be bad consequences. But one of the things is you have to not be able to get at the good thing you want to accomplish without the bad consequences. If you can, you have to try that way first.
Right, right. And if you throw that aside, so the best illustration I know of is, you know, sure, you've got a dangerous guy who is holding people hostages, and you want to, and he's threatening to kill them. So that guy needs to be stopped. It would be if you had somebody, for example, who was a really good marksman, it would be illicit in such a situation, if he was threatening to kill his hostages, to shoot that guy if you had a good marksman. Here's what you can't do, though. If the guy is holding the screaming bank teller in front of him and threatening to kill her, here's what you can't do. You can't get a marksman to shoot through the teller to kill the guy. That's that is not illicit use of double effect. because you've just killed the teller as well.
Yes. Well, and that is true. I mean, there are perhaps circumstances where, say, you have a terrorist who is wearing a bomb jacket, and
right.
if he pushes the button, it's not going to just kill him and the teller. It's going to kill everyone else in the building, and you can take him out, but you might have to take out one hostage, and then, it's the only way.
Exactly. Right. But if your first thought is, you know, I don't care who gets killed. I just, I really like killing bad guys. that's the problem. The third criteria is competent authority. This brings us to an interesting point.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Back to Connecting the Dots, where we are experiencing the magic of live radio. so we're having internet weirdness today. So hopefully we will stay on the air. We'll see how things go. We were talking about the criteria for Just War Doctrine. We talked about the fact that the threat has to be lasting, grave, and certain. That was why the Iraq War, and by the way, Just War Doctrine is like a mousetrap. You know how a mousetrap works? If all the pieces in the mousetrap are not functioning, you don't get, like, you know, a 4/5 functional mousetrap. You get a non-functional mousetrap. It just doesn't work. In the same way, all the pieces of Just War theory have to be in place, or you don't have a just war. You don't have a war that's a quarter just if you meet one criteria of just war theory, but not all the others. You just have an unjust war.
Right. And you can have you can have a case of jus ad bellum, that is, a just cause to go to war.
Right.
But still sin gravely against the criterion of jus in bello, which is the moral law as it applies to the waging of war. So just because you have a really bad oppressor and there's no way to stop them except by fighting them, and you have a good chance of success and lawful authority and all the other criteria, that doesn't mean anything goes.
Right. And that's one of the things that this goes back, of course, to the church's teaching that you cannot do evil that good may come of it. So you may have a good end in fighting your war. You know, the Japanese attacked us. This was an unjust attack on American sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to war with Japan. And then Germany declares war on us. So we're going to war with Germany as well. That's fine. And you've met the criteria for a just war. But then the way you decide to fight that war is as Bomber Harris, who was actually his nickname. He was a British general. Bomber Harris decided to fight that war against Germany with incineration raids against German civilian populations. Most famously being the firebombing of Dresden, which killed thousands and was designed to kill thousands and thousands of German civilians. This is not an accident of that bombing raid. That was the purpose of that bombing raid, was to inflict death on civilian populations, men, women, and children. That's a radical violation of jus in bello. In other words, a war crime. And so if you fight your just war by criminal means, you don't have a just war anymore. And so all of that comes into play, and the question then becomes, and this is something that, by the way, that Benedict XVI has raised. The question becomes, especially with modern methods of warfare, is it even possible anymore, if it ever was really, to have a just war? And so, as a friend of mine used to say, just war is just in theory, but is it ever just in reality? And it's a real question that's worth asking. which makes people mad, of course. And that gets to something. That frustration, that anger that a lot of people feel when you raise the possibility that it may not be possible anymore to have a just war if it ever was. People, the response that you get from people is, well, what do you want? You know, I mean, why can't we have a war? And that whole urge that's behind, that drives that response of, come on, when do I get to kill? Is exactly the reason that just war doctrine is in place. Because when your blood is up and an outrage has been committed, as was committed yesterday in London, and today, I think, what, in Antwerp? Or, you know, take your pick. Those of us who are old enough to remember it, you know, remember how we felt on 9/11. I was ready to kill a lot of people on 9/11. And it's exactly that impulse that just war and really Catholic moral teaching is there to govern, because the sin of anger is real. And when you're in the grip of the sin of anger, all you want to do is make the blood flow. And killing is part of it. Torture becomes part of it. The desire for vengeance is all over this. And it's what drives, and that was what brought this whole subject up yesterday. It's also what drives so much of what really is behind our impulse to inflict the death penalty. We want to talk about justice, and we want to talk about deterrence and keeping people safe and et cetera and et cetera. But you know what else is a huge component of it? I just want to kill that guy. I just want to see him dead, and I want to see him suffer before he dies. I want to see him suffer the way I've suffered because of what he did to me. This is why we don't put family members on juries. Family members of victims, because we know that people are not impartial. And that's, I think it's something that's very important for us to reflect on is the fact that so much of the teaching of the church is there to speak to us in our passions and to get us to stop and slow down and, you know, take deep cleansing breaths and really think about what it is we're trying to do. Because if we haven't thought about it beforehand, when the moment of passion strikes, we are capable of tremendous evils. So anyway, just wanted to finish off that discussion. How's it going?
It's going great. We were off last week, of course, because I went to Florida. I went to Ave Maria to see my mom and her husband, and that was fun.
Did you go to the Starfleet Academy Chapel?
Yes, we did.
All right.
My daughter Sarah went every day to daily mass with my mother, and Suzanne and I joined her on the last day. And
all right.
In spite of how odd it looks from the outside, and it's not exactly what I would call traditional on the inside, I do have to say that it draws its inspiration from the basic concept that has driven Catholic Church architecture since the beginning, which is that it should look like a ship. Catholic churches have been inspired by ship design. And in fact, the word that we use, nave, to describe the church space where the pews are, where you sit, or where the pews aren't in a church where there aren't pews. But that word nave comes from the Latin word for ship, and it's where we get words like naval from, you know, like naval academy. So and Starfleet Academy.
Yes.
So, you know, it all kind of ties together. I do have to say one thing about Ave Maria, though, which is that while you can get pizza there, you can't get Domino's. It's kind of funny.
That's pretty weird. For those of you who are wondering what we're talking about, here's what you do. Go online and Google Ave Maria Chapel. And when you see it and you see the front of it, it looks like the Starfleet badge on a on a Federation uniform if you're a Star Trek nerd, which I am. So there. Okay. Well, so you went to Ave Maria.
Yes.
What else is going on?
Well, I'm back now. I'm back at work and working hard. And I was feeling a little stressed this week. Okay. And I remembered that there was something I used to do a long time ago, over a year ago, in fact, to cope with stress. And I decided it's time.
And
I went. I went on Twitter and I resurrected an account that I have not used in over a year. Not my Decent Films account. I am once again writing fiction on Twitter under the handle Very Short Sequel.
Okay.
Are you part of this aspect of my life?
I am not. I've just really? Never been able to get into Twitter.
Oh, okay. Well, let me tell you a little story.
Okay.
See, back in 2012, I ran across a Twitter account that just really captured my imagination. It was called Very Short Story, and it consists of in fiction in 140 characters, usually somewhat ironic, but really kind of astonishing what you can accomplish in that space.
Okay.
And it captivated my attention, and I kept reading it and thinking, I want to do something like this. I want to write very short Twitter fiction, but how? And then I found an angle, and it came to me. I swear I am not making this up. It came to me in a dream. And I'll tell you more about it after the break.
I tingle with anticipation. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Deacon Stephen Gridanis, and we will be back on Breadbox Media right after.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with the mysterious, the elusive, the enigmatic, and yet also the rose-vestmented Deacon Steve Gridanis. Poor Deacon Steve has to wear, you know, pink this weekend, which greatly amuses me. So
yes.
I'm really looking forward to that. I presume there's going to be like pictures of you and stuff, right? We're going to get the pictures.
Oh, sure. Of course.
That's super yes. important.
And I want you to know that when I receive communion on Sunday, yeah. I'll be thinking of you and praying for your ongoing conversion from anti-Catholic sentiment and toxic masculinity culture.
Well, you know, I appreciate that. That means a lot to me. And I will just be thinking about the fact that you're wearing pink while you're taking communion, and that would make me laugh. So nobody says that it's pink, but we're all thinking it. And I just think that that makes me happy. I've been me and my kids, my four extremely masculine, one might even say toxically masculine.
Yes.
Sons have enjoyed for years making fun of our priests when they have to. There's only two times a year when they have to wear the rose vestments on Latari Sun.
No, it's entirely optional. Purple is 100% allowed.
Ah, okay. But they do it anyway.
If we wear pink or rose or whatever you want to call it, it's because we want to, not because we have to.
I'm just going to go with the fact that you yourself just called them pink.
Yes.
So anyway.
I'm not scared of the word.
Anyway. So you were talking about Twitter.
Very short story. Yes. Okay. So I discovered this account and this guy, he was writing these brilliant little microfictions in 140 characters or less. And my imagination was captivated and I wanted to do something in that vein. I'll give you a couple of examples. And then we'll go on to my inspiration. So
right.
After listening to his problems, I felt some sympathy for the devil. But I still billed him for the therapy session.
That's great.
It's great. It's great. You know, it's one sentence. It tells a little story. It's got an unexpected twist at the end. It's just lovely.
Yeah.
All right. Here's another one. Throw down your gun, they yelled. I fired at the bulldozer through an open window, defending the library against the onslaught of Kindles. Okay, one more.
Yes. Okay. One
more. Noticed her legs first, strong and lean. Long scar on the back of one. I took my time approaching, kissed her on the nose. Great horse. So I knew that I had to do something with this. And there was one story in particular that was haunting me. And I've sent you an email that has some of the stories that I've done my little thing in. And I want you, because we're going to have a little dialogue here.
Okay.
I want you to pull up the email and just read the first little story from this guy. Very short story.
Okay. I'm glad you're sleeping over, said Kent. I feel safe with you, said Lori. He turned on his Batman nightlight. Now they both felt safe.
This particular story grabbed me, and it has something to do with the names that the author chose, Kent and Lori. And then there's also the Batman nightlight. I couldn't get it out of my head, and then I woke up on a Sunday morning after a dream. This was an actual dream that I had. And I suddenly had the idea that this is what I was going to do. I was going to create a Twitter account called Very Short Sequel. And I was going to write follow-up stories to this guy's work.
I was okay.
Going to reinterpret it. To add like a twist and add my own clever interpretation to his story in the sequel. And I was delighted with this idea in the dream. And then I woke up and it was a Sunday morning and I just lay there in bed and I thought of my idea and I realized that even though I was awake, it still made sense. You know how you have those brilliant ideas sometimes in dreams? Like, it might be a great idea for a novel or a brilliant apologetical argument or something. And then you wake up and you try to reconstruct your thought. You're like, what was I thinking?
Yes. Yes. You know, I spent this morning, actually, I spent a good long time this morning having a protracted conversation with Irving Berlin. I have no idea why. But anyway.
So I was. Just and so I immediately went out and I created the account, and by the end of I probably came up with the answer to the story in mass. My mind may have been wandering a little and I may have been thinking about sequels in mass that day because I was
That was how the Screwtape Letters was born, you know.
Yes. Well, this was back in 2012. This was before my diaconal vocation, so So let me now tell you the very first sequel that I ever wrote.
Okay.
Can you read the story again? Just read it again.
"I'm glad you're sleeping over," said Kent. "I feel safe with you," said Laurie. He turned on his Batman nightlight. Now they both felt safe.
Bruce smiled as he listened via Kent's Batman radio monitor. He knew that Kent was Superman, but not that Laurie was a mermaid.
I was actually thinking about that. I was actually going, wait, is this Clark Kent and Laurie the Mermaid?
Right, Laurie Lamoris and Clark
Kent. That's amazing. Okay.
And Batman Nightlight is a radio monitor. And he's safe because Batman is watching over him.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I've been doing this, not continuously because I took a year hiatus, but I've been doing this since 2012. And I've got some, sometimes they're funny. One of my favorite things to do is I take a dark or subversive story and I twist it in a redemptive direction.
Okay.
But sometimes I do the opposite. I take a hopeful story and I give it a dark twist.
Okay.
And sometimes I make a serious point. So let's do some more. Read the next one.
I woke to a pack of wolves in the kitchen, howling at the fridge. I fed them frozen waffles, and one by one, they turned back into my children.
A warning growl scattered the former wolves, and a bear lumbered in. Stronger magic was needed. I opened the coffee bean.
Good. All right, let's see. The Book of Wisdom was blank because its vocabulary and arguments were often abstruse. The wise added an appendix, also blank.
A 10-volume commentary was written for the Book of Wisdom. It had clear, easy-to-read explanations, authored by the foolish.
Cool. All right, Thank you. All right, here's the next one. We are not allowed to dream. Why not? Because the generals rule. So what? They have outlawed dreams.
It sounds like a nightmare. Yes, those are allowed.
Okay. I opened the door on the left, knowing it contained the tiger or the princess. As the tiger leapt on me, I begged the king for a do-over.
To my surprise, the king agreed, and I opened the other door. Too late, as the princess leapt on me, I awake.
What was the last line?
Too late, as the princess leapt on me, I realized my mistake.
That's good. A day before, they discussed Plato's take on love and relationships, feeling enlightened and all later. Now she was hurling plates at him.
No more, he begged. They're circles, perfect shapes. She snorted. Imperfect approximations. Your plate flew. See?
Okay, let's see. Martha snuggled up to Rick. He smelled so good. So many questions she wanted to ask about his life. It made her wish he was still alive.
And just like that, he was. Her wishes were like that. Not again, Rick moaned. Why did you wish I was dead this time?
That's great. I woke up as a dog sled in Alaska. Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Well, we got a do-over. The king gives us a do-over. We will be back right after this on Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. And we will be back on Redbox Media in just a minute.
you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here with Deacon Stephen Granados, Twitter novelist. And we're having fun here today. We're playing games with what's the name of your Twitter account again?
Very Short Sequel. It came to me in a dream. Actually, that's not entirely true. The version in the dream I thought, because the Twitter account that I was inspired by was Very Short Story, and I thought that I was going to call my account Short Story Sequel. That was the title in the dream. When I tried it in real life, it turned out it was one letter too long. So I changed, but Very Short Sequel did work, and okay. So that's what I went with. And I have been doing it, for a number of years now, and it's great because, you know, first of all, when you sequelify somebody's story and they're not expecting it, it's kind of there's a little bit of anxiety there because you are offering an unauthorized reinterpretation and redirection of someone else's story. I mean, they did their thing and maybe they're proud of it, and they don't appreciate the fact that suddenly you turned kind of nerdy guy with the Batman nightlight into Superman, or that the woman snuggling up against the dead body has magical wishing powers and people die and come alive every time she thinks about it. So, but for the most part, I have to say that the authors have been very, very gratifying in their enthusiasm for what I was doing, and they were always, many of them were flattered, and many of them would retweet it. And I wound up getting, a couple thousand followers on Twitter, largely on the strength of these other people liking my work. And then also because I would retweet myself as decent films. And
cheater.
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of fun. And I made some friends, and then on a sad note, I was going back and looking at some of the people that I used to sequelify as I've been getting back to it this week. And I discovered that one guy whose work I particularly admired and who had provided a particularly challenging source for me to sequel, that he died in that year that I was away. Yeah. And his daughter wrote a very nice note. It was the last tweet on his account, the last tweet probably there'll ever be on his account, saying that he had passed away peacefully and thanking everyone for being part of this community, this writing community that she loved so much and that her father loved so much, and being a part of his amazing life. And,
Well, I think what I love about this is it's sort of like short story haiku. I mean, it's
– yes.
And I like the smallness of it. One of the things that I remember taking a lit class on uh, 19th century literature, and one of the things that the rising how should you put it, the rise of a middle class in England and the United States allowed was leisure. And that's what you need in order to have any kind of community that can do any writing. If you're just constantly living this hand-to-mouth existence, then you don't have time to write anything.
I'm blanking on the name of the book about leisure.
I know you're talking about Huizinga's book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture.
Yes, that. Thank you.
Yeah. That's what made it what made the Bible possible was the establishment of a leisurely, literary, and priestly class. So if you're constantly just living this hard scrabble existence of, you know, pastoring sheep, breaking your back all day, working hard, you don't have time to write, you know. Right.
And that's what I find. That's why it's kind of refreshing to me to do this. It's a break from, you know, the daily. So let's do the last one.
Let's do it. We got four more. Okay. So what I'm doing is I'm reading the original story, and then you're giving your sequel.
Yes.
So here's the original short story. I woke up as a sled dog in Alaska, having made my final wish in a drunken blackout, a result of the rum from wish number two.
So I hear something like that. I think, what can I do with, where can I go? How can I possibly get this guy out of that? And what I come up with is this. My mind raced to my first best wish, the 24-hour do-over button at home in Seattle. I had many miles to go in a short time.
Okay. That's good. Man, that'd have to be a fast dog to get from Alaska to Seattle. I opened the largest box first and found a coffin with my name on it. My children had learned to give practical gifts that people could use.
The next package was a mirror, so the kids still loved gag gifts. Well, I guess it goes in the guest room with the silver. The coffin is a practical gift people could use. The mirror and the silver are gag gifts. Because it's a family of vampires!
All right. They sleep safe. Excuse me. They sleep safely in their beds because rough men stand ready in the night to visit violence on those who would do them harm.
So they told themselves. Until the night, the rough men burst in while they were sleeping and dragged them from their own beds.
Okay. That's good. Yeah, that's a quote from Orwell.
Yes.
A rare moment. None of the children were screaming. Nothing to rush to. Money in the bank. He remembered for an instant he loved her.
When he told her, she said, "If you don't remember, when the kids are screaming and all hell is breaking loose, it isn't love."
Ooh. That's good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's fun. This is what I've been doing. And if you, anybody who's listening who's interested in what you've been hearing, you can go to Very Short Sequel and you can see the handful of sequels that I've written just this week. I started yesterday. I put up three yesterday and I put up three more today. And I'm having fun. And
that's cool.
It looks like more people are following me again now that they see that I'm writing. So that's fun too.
Oh, goody. Well, that's very cool. Yeah, I've been trying my hand at a much longer novel, which is, you know, novel writing is hard.
Yes, it is.
It's really hard. I can write essays in my sleep practically, but yeah, inventing people and worlds and things, that's really hard. I have nothing but respect for people that sit down and could just write fiction like that. I think some people, you know, just have a knack for it. I do not. We'll see how it works. I've gotten one chapter done and I'm kind of halfway into a second chapter. And
now is it the kind of thing where you know where you're going and it's a question of how to get there, or how are you? Because every author has a different approach to writing.
Well, for me, I've got part of the story mapped out. I know where things are going to go up until about the end of the first act. Mm. Actually, yeah, and into the second act. But how we get to the third act, I have no idea. For me, a lot of it, part of the newness for me is kind of letting characters talk to each other. And in that, we discover who they are and what they think. And I'm just kind of letting them talk and seeing what they say. And it's kind of it's weird the way that a character will take on a life of his own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
And it really is like somebody who's distinct from you. You know, you start realizing I would like them to do this, but they wouldn't actually do that.
Right. And they surprise you and they take the story in directions that you didn't expect.
Yeah.
And there are things that you want them to do and you can't quite get them to do that thing.
Exactly. So, yeah, for me, partly I'm dealing with fictional characters, but also fictional characters in a real historical setting. And so
that's something else that pushes back on you.
Yeah. And so there's things that they can't do. Right. You know, if you're my characters aren't going to be there. But if your characters decide to vacation in Hawaii on December 7th, 1941, they're just not going to have the fun time they thought they were going to have because there are certain constraints on what's going to be taking place that day. And right now, I'm just kind of letting my characters go on and talk to each other and kind of discovering what it is they say to each other. And it's excuse me, it's a different kind of writing altogether than what I'm used to, which is nonfiction primarily. Mm-hmm. And so I'll see where that goes. Right now I got to do some research because my characters are doing things in a particular place that I don't know anything about and I can't make it up. So no. I have to go find out about it. So if you're writing complete fiction set on some other world, you can do that. But
that's why the one novel that I finished actually follows that format. I discovered the other didn't work for me.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, Mr. Deacon Stephen Gerdanis. And I want to thank Danny Head for his great job as our producer. And I want to thank you guys out there for listening. And I will talk to you tomorrow on Connecting the Dots. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.